This is Audible.
HarperCollins and Harper Audio present Everything is Fucked, A Book About Hope by Mark Manson. This is the author. For Fernanda, of course. Part 1. Hope. Chapter 1. The Uncomfortable Truth. On a small plot of land in the monotonous countryside of Central Europe, amid the warehouses of a former military barracks, a nexus of geographically concentrated evil would arise, denser and darker than anything the world had ever seen. Over the span of 4 years, more than 1.3 million people would be systematically sorted, enslaved, tortured, and murdered here. And it would all happen in an area slightly larger than Central Park in Manhattan. And no one would do anything to stop it. Except for one man. It is the stuff of fairy tales and comic books. A hero marches headlong into the fiery jaws of hell to confront some great manifestation of evil. The odds are impossible. The rationale is laughable. Yet our fantastical hero never hesitates. He never flinches. He stands tall and slays the dragon, crushes the demon invaders, saves the planet, and maybe even a princess or two. And for a brief time, there is hope. But this is not a story of hope. This is a story of everything being completely and utterly fucked. Fucked in proportions and on scales that today, with the comfort of our free Wi-Fi and oversized snuggy blankets, you and I can hardly imagine. Like a hipster who loved the band before they were famous, let me tell you, Witold Pilecki was already a war hero before he decided to sneak into Auschwitz. As a young man, Pilecki had been a decorated officer in the Polish-Soviet War of 1918. He had kicked the communists in the nuts before most people even knew what a pinko commie bastard was. After the war, Pilecki moved to the Polish countryside, married a schoolteacher, and had two kids. He enjoyed riding horses and wearing fancy hats and smoking cigars. Life was simple and good. Then that whole Hitler thing happened, and before Poland could get both its boots on, the Nazis had already blitzkrieged through half the country. Poland lost half its entire territory in little more than a month. It wasn't exactly a fair fight. While the Nazis invaded in the west, the Soviets invaded in the east. It was like being stuck between a rock and a hard place, except the rock was a megalomaniacal mass murderer trying to conquer the world, and the hard place was rampant, senseless genocide. I'm still not sure which was which. Early on, the Soviets were actually far crueler than the Nazis. They had done this shit before, you know. The whole overthrow a government and enslave a population to your faulty ideology thing. The Nazis were still somewhat imperialist virgins, which, when you look at pictures of Hitler's mustache, isn't hard to imagine. In those first months of the war, it's estimated that the Soviets rounded up over 1 million Polish citizens and sent them east. Think about that for a second. 1 million people, in a matter of months, just gone. Some didn't stop until they hit the gulags in Siberia. Others were found in mass graves decades later. Many are still unaccounted for to this day. Pilecki fought in those battles, of course, against both the Germans and the Soviets. And after their defeat, he and fellow Polish officers started an underground resistance group in Warsaw. They called themselves the Secret Polish Army. In the spring of 1940, the Secret Polish Army got wind of the fact that the Germans were building a massive prison complex outside some backwater town in the southern part of the country. The Germans named this new prison complex Auschwitz. By the summer of 1940, thousands of military officers and leading Polish nationals were disappearing from Western Poland. Fears arose among the resistance that the mass incarceration that had occurred in the East with the Soviets was now on the menu in the West. Pilecki and his crew suspected that Auschwitz, a prison the size of a small town, was likely involved in the disappearances and that it might already house thousands of former Polish soldiers. That's when Pilecki volunteered to sneak into Auschwitz. Initially, it was a rescue mission. He would allow himself to get arrested, and once there, he would organize with other Polish soldiers, coordinate a mutiny, and break out of the prison camp. It was a mission so suicidal that he might as well have asked his commander permission to drink a bucket of bleach. His superiors thought he was crazy and told him as much. But as the weeks went by, the problem only grew worse. Thousands of elite Poles were disappearing, and Auschwitz was still a huge blind spot in the Allied intelligence network. The Allies had no idea what was going on there, and little chance of finding out. Eventually, Pileski's commanders relented. One evening, at a routine checkpoint in Warsaw, Pileski let himself be arrested by the SS for violating curfew. And soon, he was on his way to Auschwitz, the only man known ever to have voluntarily entered a Nazi concentration camp. Once he got there, he saw that the reality of Auschwitz was far worse than anyone had suspected. Prisoners were routinely shot in roll call lineups for transgressions as minor as fidgeting or not standing up straight. The manual labor was grueling and endless. Men were literally worked to death, often performing tasks that were useless or meant nothing. The first month Pileski was there, a full third of the men in his barracks died of exhaustion or pneumonia or were shot. Regardless, by the end of 1940, Pileski, the comic book superhero motherfucker, had still somehow set up an espionage operation. Oh, Pileski, you titan, you champion, flying above the abyss, how did you manage to create an intelligence network by embedding messages in laundry baskets? How did you build your own transistor radio out of spare parts and stolen batteries, MacGyver style, and then successfully transmit plans for an attack on the prison camp to the secret Polish army in Warsaw? How did you create smuggling rings to bring in food, medicine, and clothing for prisoners, saving countless lives and delivering hope to the remotest desert of the human heart? What did this world do to deserve you? Over the course of 2 years, Pileski built an entire resistance unit within Auschwitz. There was a chain of command with ranks and officers, a supply chain, and lines of communication to the outside world. And all of this went undiscovered by the SS guards for almost 2 years. Pileski's ultimate aim was to foment a full-scale revolt within the camp. With help and coordination from the outside, he believed he could stoke a prison break, overrun the undermanned SS guards, and release tens of thousands of highly trained Polish guerrilla fighters into the wild. He sent his plans and reports to Warsaw, and then he waited. For months, he survived. But then came the Jews, first in buses, then packed in train cars. Soon they were arriving by the tens of thousands, an undulating current of people floating in an ocean of death and despair. Stripped of all family possessions and dignity, they filed mechanically into the newly renovated shower barracks, where they were gassed and their bodies burned. Pileski's reports to the outside became frantic. They're murdering tens of thousands of people here each day, mostly Jews. The death toll could potentially be in the millions. He pleaded with the secret Polish army to liberate the camp at once. He said, if you can't liberate the camp, then at least bomb it. For God's sake, at least destroy the gas chambers. At least. The secret Polish army received his messages, but figured he was exaggerating. In the farthest reaches of their minds, nothing could be that fucked. Nothing. Pileski was the first person ever to alert the world to the Holocaust. His intelligence was forwarded through the various resistance groups around Poland, then on to the Polish government in exile in the United Kingdom, who then passed his reports to the Allied command in London. The information eventually even made its way to Eisenhower and Churchill. They, too, figured Pileski had to be exaggerating. In 1943, Pileski realized that his plans of a mutiny and prison break were never going to happen. The secret Polish army wasn't coming, the Americans and British weren't coming, and in all likelihood, it was the Soviets who were coming, and they would be worse. Pileski decided that remaining inside the camp was too risky. It was time to escape. He made it look easy, of course. First, he faked illness and got himself admitted to the camp's hospital. From there, he lied to the doctors about what work group he was supposed to return to, saying he had the night shift at the bakery, which was on the edge of camp, near the river. When the doctors discharged him, he headed to the bakery, where he proceeded to work until 2 a.m., when the last batch of bread finished baking. From there, it was just a matter of cutting the telephone wire, silently prying open the back door, changing into stolen civilian clothes without the SS guards noticing, sprinting to the river a mile away while being shot at, and then navigating his way back to civilization via the stars. Today, much in our world appears to be fucked. Not quite Nazi Holocaust level fucked, not even close, but still pretty fucked nonetheless. Stories such as Pilecki's inspire us. They give us hope. They make us say, well, damn, things were way worse then, and that guy transcended it all. What have I done lately? Which, in this couch potato pundit era of tweet storms and outrage porn, is probably what we should be asking ourselves. When we zoom out and get perspective, we realize that while heroes like Pilecki save the world, we swat at gnats and complain that the AC isn't high enough. Pilecki's story is the single most heroic thing I've ever come across in my life, because heroism isn't just bravery or guts or shrewd maneuvering. These things are common and are often used in unheroic ways. No, being heroic is the ability to conjure hope where there is none, to strike a match and light up the void, to show us a possibility for a better world. Not a better world that we want to exist, but a better world we didn't know could exist. To take a situation where everything seems to be absolutely fucked and still somehow make it good. Bravery and resilience are one thing, but heroism has a philosophical component to it. Heroes bring a great why to the table, some incredible cause or belief that goes unshaken, no matter what. And this is why, as a culture, we are so desperate for a hero today. Not because things are necessarily so bad, but because we've lost the clear why that drove previous generations. We are a culture in need not of peace or prosperity or new hood ornaments for our electric cars. We have all that. We are a culture in need of something far more precarious. We are a culture and a people in need of hope. After witnessing years of war, torture, death, and genocide, Pilecki never lost hope. Despite losing his country, his family, his friends, and nearly his own life, he never lost hope. Even after the war, while enduring Soviet domination, he never lost the hope of a free and independent Poland. He never lost the hope of a quiet and happy life for his children. He never lost the hope of being able to save a few more lives, of helping a few more people. After the war, Pilecki returned to Warsaw and continued spying, this time on the Communist Party, which had just come to power there. Again, he would be the first person to notify the West of an ongoing evil, in this case that the Soviets had infiltrated the Polish government and rigged its elections. He would also be the first to document the Soviet atrocities committed in the East during the war. This time, though, he was discovered. He was warned that he was about to be arrested, and he had a chance to flee to Italy. Yet, Pilecki declined. He would rather stay and die Polish than run and live as something he didn't recognize. A free and independent Poland, by then, was his only source of hope. Without it, he was nothing. And thus, his hope would also be his undoing. The communists captured Pilecki in 1947, and they didn't go easy on him. He was tortured for almost a year, so harshly and consistently that he told his wife that Auschwitz was just a trifle by comparison. Still, he never cooperated with his interrogators. Eventually, realizing they could get no information from him, the communists decided to make an example of him. In 1948, they held a show trial and charged Pilecki with everything from falsifying documents and violating curfew to engaging in espionage and treason. A month later, he was found guilty and sentenced to death. On the final day of the trial, Pilecki was allowed to speak. He stated that his allegiance had always been to Poland and its people, that he had never harmed or betrayed any Polish citizen, and that he regretted nothing. He concluded his statement with, quote, "I have tried to live my life such that in the hour of my death, I would feel joy rather than fear." And if that's not the most hardcore thing you've ever heard, then I want some of what you're having. How may I help you? If I worked at Starbucks, instead of writing people's names on their coffee cup, I'd write the following. One day, you and everyone you love will die. And beyond a small group of people for an extremely brief period of time, little of what you say or do will ever matter. This is the uncomfortable truth of life, and everything you think or do is but an elaborate avoidance of it. We are inconsequential cosmic dust, bumping and milling about on a tiny blue speck. We imagine our own importance. We invent our purpose. We are nothing. Enjoy your fucking coffee. I'd have to write it in really tiny lettering, of course. And it'd take a while to write, meaning the line of morning rush hour customers would be backed out the door. Not exactly stellar customer service, either. This is probably just one of the reasons I'm not employable. But seriously, how could you tell someone, in good conscience, to have a nice day while knowing that all their thoughts and motivations stem from a never-ending need to avoid the inherent meaninglessness of human existence? Because in the infinite expanse of space-time, the universe does not care whether your mother's hip replacement goes well, or your kids attend college, or your boss thinks you made a bitching spreadsheet. It doesn't care if the Democrats or the Republicans win the presidential election. It doesn't care if a celebrity gets caught doing cocaine while furiously masturbating in the airport bathroom. Again. It doesn't care if the forests burn, or the ice melts, or the waters rise, or the airs simmer, or we all get vaporized by a superior alien race. You care. You care, and you desperately convince yourself that because you care, it all must have some great cosmic meaning behind it. You care because deep down, you need to feel that sense of importance in order to avoid the uncomfortable truth, to avoid the incomprehensibility of your existence, to avoid being crushed by the weight of your own material insignificance. And you, like me, like everyone, then project that imagined sense of importance onto the world around you, because it gives you hope. Is it too early to have this conversation? Here, have another coffee. I even made a winky smiley face with the steamed milk. Isn't it cute? Here, I'll wait while you Instagram it. Okay, where were we? Oh yeah, the incomprehensibility of your existence. Right. Now, you might be thinking, well, Mark, I believe we're all here for a reason, and nothing is a coincidence, and everyone matters, because all our actions affect somebody, and even if we can help one person, then it's still worth it, right? No, now aren't you as cute as a button? See, that's your hope talking, and that's a story your mind spins to make it worth waking up in the morning. Something needs to matter, because without something mattering, then there's no reason to go on living. And some form of simple altruism or a reduction in suffering is always our mind's go-to for making it feel like it's worth doing anything. Our psyche needs hope to survive the way a fish needs water. Hope is the fuel for our mental engine. It's the butter on our biscuit. It's a lot of really cheesy metaphors. Without hope, your whole mental apparatus will stall out or starve. If we don't believe there's any hope that the future will be better than the present, that our life will improve in some way, then we spiritually die. After all, if there's no hope of things ever being better, then why live? Why do anything? Here's what a lot of people don't get. The opposite of happiness is not anger or sadness. If you're angry or sad, that means you still give a fuck about something. That means something still matters. That means you still have hope. No, the opposite of happiness is hopelessness. An endless gray horizon of resignation and indifference. It's the belief that everything is fucked, so why do anything at all? Hopelessness is a cold and bleak nihilism, a sense that there is no point, so fuck it. Why not run with scissors, or sleep with your boss's wife, or shoot up a school? It is the uncomfortable truth, a silent realization that in the face of infinity, everything we could possibly care about quickly approaches zero. Hopelessness is the root of anxiety, mental illness, and depression. It is the source of all misery and the cause of all addiction. This is not an overstatement. Chronic anxiety is a crisis of hope. It is the fear of a failed future. Depression is a crisis of hope. It is the belief in a meaningless future. Delusion, addiction, obsession, these are all the mind's desperate and compulsive attempts at generating hope, one neurotic tick or obsessive craving at a time. The avoidance of hopelessness, that is, the construction of hope, then becomes our mind's primary project. All meaning, everything we understand about ourselves and the world, is constructed for the purpose of maintaining hope. Therefore, hope is the only thing any of us willingly dies for. Hope is what we believe to be greater than ourselves. Without it, we believe we are nothing. When I was in college, my grandfather died. For a few years afterward, I had this intense feeling that I must live in such a way as to make him proud. This felt reasonable and obvious on some deep level, but it wasn't. In fact, it made no logical sense at all. I hadn't had a close relationship with my grandfather. We'd never talked on the phone. We hadn't corresponded. I didn't even see him the last 5 years or so that he was alive. Not to mention, he was dead. How did my living to make him proud affect anything? His death caused me to brush up against that uncomfortable truth. So my mind got to work, looking to build hope out of the situation in order to sustain me, to keep any nihilism at bay. My mind decided that because my grandfather was now deprived of his ability to hope and aspire in his own life, it was important for me to carry on hope and aspiration in his honor. This was my mind's bite-sized piece of faith, my own personal mini-religion of purpose. And it worked. For a short while, his death infused otherwise banal and empty experiences with import and meaning. And that meaning gave me hope. You've probably felt something similar when someone close to you passed away. It's a common feeling. You tell yourself you'll live in a way that will make your loved one proud. You tell yourself you will use your life to celebrate his. You tell yourself that this is an important and good thing. And that good thing is what sustains us in these moments of existential terror. I walked around imagining that my grandfather was following me, like a really nosy ghost, constantly looking over my shoulder. This man, whom I barely knew when he was alive, was now somehow extremely concerned with how I did on my calculus exam. It was totally irrational. Our psyches construct little narratives like this whenever they face adversity, these before and after stories we invent for ourselves. And we must keep these hope narratives alive, all the time, even if they become unreasonable or destructive, as they are the only stabilizing force protecting our minds from the uncomfortable truth. These hope narratives are then what give our lives a sense of purpose. Not only do they imply that there is something better in the future, but also that it's actually possible to go out and achieve that something. When people prattle on about needing to find their life's purpose, what they really mean is that it's no longer clear to them what matters, what is a worthy use of their limited time here on Earth. In short, what to hope for. They're struggling to see what the before and after of their lives should be. That's the hard part, finding that before and after for yourself. It's difficult because there's no way to ever know for sure if you've got it right. This is why a lot of people flock to religion, because religions acknowledge this permanent state of unknowing and demand faith in the face of it. This is also probably partly why religious people suffer from depression and commit suicide in far fewer numbers than non-religious people. That practice faith protects them from the uncomfortable truth. But your hope narratives don't need to be religious. They can be anything. This book is my little source of hope. It gives me purpose. It gives me meaning. And the narrative that I have constructed around that hope is that I believe this book might help some people, that it might make both my life and the world a little bit better. Do I know that for sure? No. But it's my little before and after story, and I'm sticking to it. It gets me up in the morning. It gets me excited about my life. And not only is that not a bad thing, it's the only thing. For some people, the before and after story is raising their kids well. For others, it's saving the environment. For others, it's making a bunch of money and buying a big-ass boat. For others, it's simply trying to improve their golf swing. Whether we realize it or not, we all have these narratives we've elected to buy into for whatever reason. It doesn't matter if the way you get to hope is via religious faith or evidence-based theory or an intuition or a well-reasoned argument. They all produce the same result. You have some belief that A, there is potential for growth or improvement or salvation in the future, and B, there are ways we can navigate ourselves to get there. That's it. Day after day, year after year, our lives are made up of the endless overlapping of these hope narratives. They are the psychological carrot at the end of the stick. If this all sounds nihilistic, please, don't get the wrong idea. This book is not an argument for nihilism. It is one against nihilism. Both the nihilism within us and the growing sense of nihilism that seems to emerge with the modern world. And to successfully argue against nihilism, you must start at nihilism. You must start at the uncomfortable truth. From there, you must slowly build a convincing case for hope. And not just any hope, but a sustainable, benevolent form of hope. A hope that can bring us together rather than tear us apart. A hope that is robust and powerful, yet still grounded in reason and reality. A hope that can carry us to the end of our days with a sense of gratitude and satisfaction. This is not easy to do, obviously. And in the 21st century, it's arguably more difficult than ever. Nihilism and the pure indulgence of desire that accompanies it are gripping the modern world. It is power for the sake of power, success for the sake of success, pleasure for the sake of pleasure. Nihilism acknowledges no broader why. It adheres to no great truth or cause. It is a simple, because it feels good. And this, as we'll see, is what is making everything seem so bad. The paradox of progress. We live in an interesting time in that, materially, things are arguably better than they have ever been before. Yet we all seem to be losing our minds thinking the world is one giant toilet bowl about to be flushed. An irrational sense of hopelessness is spreading across the rich, developed world. It's a paradox of progress. The better things get, the more anxious and desperate we all seem to feel. In recent years, writers such as Steven Pinker and Hans Rosling have been making the case that we're wrong to feel so pessimistic, that things are, in fact, the best they've ever been and likely going to get even better. Both men have filled long, heavy books with many charts and graphs that start at one corner and always somehow end up in the opposite corner. Both men have explained, at length, the biases and incorrect assumptions we all carry that cause us to feel that things are so much worse than they are. Progress, they argue, has continued uninterrupted throughout modern history. People are more educated and literate than ever before. Violence has trended down for decades, possibly centuries. Racism, sexism, discrimination, and violence against women are at their lowest points in recorded history. We have more rights than ever before. Half the planet has access to the internet. Extreme poverty is at an all-time low worldwide. Wars are smaller and less frequent than at any other time in recorded history. Children are dying less, and people are living longer. There's more wealth than ever before. We've, like, cured a bunch of diseases and stuff. And they're right. It's important to know these facts. But reading these books is also kind of like listening to your Uncle Larry prattle on about how much worse things were when he was your age. Even though he's right, it doesn't necessarily make you feel any better about your problems. Because for all the good news being published today, here's some other surprising statistics. In the United States, symptoms of depression and anxiety are on an 80-year upswing among young people, and a 20-year upswing among the adult population. Not only are people experiencing depression in greater numbers, but they're experiencing it at earlier ages with each generation. Since 1985, men and women have reported lower levels of life satisfaction. Part of that is probably because stress levels have risen over the past 30 years. Drug overdoses have recently hit an all-time high, as the opioid crisis has wrecked much of the United States and Canada. Across the U.S. population, feelings of loneliness and social isolation are up. Nearly half of all Americans now report feeling isolated, left out, or alone in their lives. Social trust is also not only down across the developed world, but plummeting, meaning fewer people than ever trust their government, the media, or one another. In the 1980s, when researchers asked survey participants how many people they had discussed important personal matters with over the previous 6 months, the most common answer was 3. By 2006, the most common answer was 0. Meanwhile, the environment is completely fucked. Nutjobs either have access to nuclear weapons or are a hop, skip, and a jump away from getting them. Extremism across the world continues to grow, in all forms, on both the right and the left, both religious and secular. Conspiracy theorists, citizen militias, survivalists, and preppers, as in prepping for Armageddon, are all becoming more popular subcultures, to the point where they are borderline mainstream. Basically, we are the safest and most prosperous humans in the history of the world, yet we are feeling more hopeless than ever before. The better things get, the more we seem to despair. It's the paradox of progress, and perhaps it can be summed up in one startling fact. The wealthier and safer the place you live, the more likely you are to commit suicide. The incredible progress made in health, safety, and material wealth over the past few hundred years is not to be denied. But these are statistics about the past, not the future. And that's where hope inevitably must be found, in our visions of the future. Because hope is not based on statistics. Hope doesn't care about the downward trend of gun-related deaths or car accident fatalities. It doesn't care that there wasn't a commercial plane crash last year, or that literacy hit an all-time high in Mongolia. Well, unless you're Mongolian. Hope doesn't care about the problems that have already been solved. Hope cares only about the problems that still need to be solved. Because the better the world gets, the more we have to lose. And the more we have to lose, the less we feel we have to hope for. To build and maintain hope, we need 3 things. A sense of control, a belief in the value of something, and a community. Control means we feel as though we're in control of our own life, that we can affect our fate. Values means that we find something important enough to work toward, something better, something that's worth striving for. And community means that we are part of a group that values the same things we do and is working towards achieving those things. Without a community, we feel isolated and our values cease to mean anything. Without values, nothing appears worth pursuing. And without control, we feel powerless to pursue anything. Lose any of the 3, and you lose the other 2. Lose any of the 3, and you lose hope. The next 3 chapters will look at how we develop these 3 areas of our lives, respectively, our sense of control, our values, and our communities. For us to understand why we're suffering through such a crisis of hope today, we need to understand the mechanics of hope, how it is generated and maintained. We will then return to the original question, what is happening in our world that is causing us to feel worse, despite everything consistently getting better? And the answer might surprise you. Chapter 2. Self-control is an illusion. It all started with a headache. Elliot was a successful man, an executive at a successful company. He was well-liked by his coworkers and neighbors. He could be charming and disarmingly funny. He was a husband and a father and a friend, and he took sweet-ass beach vacations. Except he had headaches, regularly. And these weren't your typical pop and Advil type headaches. These were mind-crunching, corkscrewing headaches, like a wrecking ball banging against the back of your eye sockets. Elliot took medicine, he took naps, He tried to de-stress and chill out and hang loose and brush it off and suck it up. Yet the headaches continued. In fact, they only got worse. Soon they became so severe that Elliot couldn't sleep at night or work during the day. Finally, he went to a doctor. The doctor did doctor things and ran doctor tests and received the doctor results and told Elliot the bad news. He had a brain tumor, right there on his frontal lobe. Right there. See it? That gray blotch in the front. And man, is it a big one. Size of a baseball, I reckon. The surgeon cut the tumor out, and Elliot went home. He went back to work. He went back to his family and friends. Everything seemed fine and normal. Then things went horribly wrong. Elliot's work performance suffered. Tasks that were once a breeze to him now required mountains of concentration and effort. Simple decisions, such as whether to use a blue pen or black pen, would consume him for hours. He would make basic errors and leave them unfixed for weeks. He became a scheduling black hole, missing meetings and deadlines as if they were an insult to the fabric of space-time itself. At first, his co-workers felt bad and covered for him. After all, the guy had just had a tumor the size of a small fruit basket cut out of his head. But then the covering became too much for them, and Elliot's excuses too unreasonable. You skipped an investors' meeting to buy a new stapler, Elliot? Really? What were you thinking? After months of the botched meetings and the bullshit, the truth was undeniable. Elliot had lost something more than a tumor in the surgery, and as far as his colleagues were concerned, that something was a shitload of company money. So, Elliot was fired. Meanwhile, his home life wasn't faring much better. Imagine if you took a deadbeat dad, stuffed him inside a couch potato, lightly glazed it with Family Feud reruns, and baked it at 350 degrees for 24 hours a day. That was Elliot's new life. He missed his son's Little League games. He skipped a parent-teacher conference to watch a James Bond marathon on TV. He forgot that his wife generally preferred it if he spoke to her more than once a week. Fights erupted in Elliot's marriage along new and unexpected fault lines. Except, they couldn't really be considered fights. Fights require that two people give a shit. And while his wife breathed fire, Elliot had trouble following the plot. Instead of acting with urgency to change or patch things up, to show that he loved and cared for these people who were his own, he remained isolated and indifferent. It was as though he were living in another area code, one never quite reachable from anywhere on Earth. Eventually, his wife couldn't take it anymore. Elliot had lost something else besides that tumor, she yelled, and that something was called his goddamn heart. She divorced him and took the kids, and Elliot was alone. Dejected and confused, Elliot began looking for ways to restart his career. He got sucked into some bad business ventures. A scam artist conned him out of much of his savings. A predatory woman seduced him, convinced him to elope, and then divorced him a year later, making off with half of his assets. He loafed around town, settling in increasingly cheaper and shittier apartments, until after a few years, he was effectively homeless. His brother took him in and began supporting him. Friends and family looked on aghast, while over a few short years a man they once admired essentially threw his life away. No one could make sense of it. He had lost something, his friends murmured, and they had no fucking clue what it was. It was undeniable that something in Elliot had changed, that those debilitating headaches had caused more than pain. Question was, what? Elliot's brother chaperoned him from one doctor's visit to the next. He's not himself, the brother would say. He has a problem. He seems fine, but he's not. I promise. The doctors did their doctor things and received their doctor results, and unfortunately, they said that Elliot was perfectly normal. Or, at least, he fit their definition of normal. Above average, even. His CAT scans looked fine. His IQ was still high. His reasoning was solid. His memory was great. He could discuss at length the repercussions and consequences of his poor choices. He could converse on a wide range of subjects with humor and charm. His psychiatrist said Elliot wasn't depressed. On the contrary, he had high self-esteem, and no signs of chronic anxiety or stress. Indeed, he exhibited almost zen-like calm in the eye of a hurricane caused by his own negligence. His brother couldn't accept this. Something was wrong. Something was missing in him. Finally, in desperation, Elliot was referred to a famous neuroscientist named Antonio Damasio. Initially, Antonio Damasio did the same things the other doctors had done. He gave Elliot a bunch of cognitive tests: memory, reflexes, intelligence, personality, spatial relations, moral reasoning. Everything checked out. Elliot passed with flying colors. Then Damasio did something that Elliot no other doctor had thought to do. He talked to him. He wanted to know everything, every mistake, every error, every regret. How had he lost his job, his family, his house, his savings? Take me through each decision. Explain the thought process, or in this case, the lack of a thought process. Elliot could explain at length what decisions he had made, but he couldn't explain the why of those decisions. He could recount facts and sequences of events with perfect fluidity and even a certain dramatic flair. But when asked to analyze his decision-making, why did he decide that buying a new stapler was more important than meeting with an investor? Why did he decide that James Bond was more interesting than his kids? He was at a loss. He had no answers. And not only that, he wasn't even upset about having no answers. In fact, he didn't care. This was a man who had lost everything due to his own poor choices and mistakes, who had exhibited no self-control whatsoever, and who was completely aware of the disaster his life had become. And yet he apparently showed no remorse, no self-loathing, not even a little bit of embarrassment. Many people have been driven to suicide for less than what Elliot had endured. Yet there he was, not only comfortable with his own misfortune, but indifferent to it. That's when Damasio had a brilliant realization. The psychological tests Elliot had undergone were designed to measure his ability to think, but none of the tests were designed to measure his ability to feel. Every doctor had been so concerned about Elliot's reasoning abilities that no one had stopped to consider that it was Elliot's capacity for emotion that had been damaged. And even if they had realized it, there was no standardized way of measuring that damage. One day, one of Damasio's colleagues printed up a bunch of grotesque and disturbing pictures. There were burn victims, gruesome murder scenes, war-torn cities, starving children. He then showed Elliot the photos, one by one. And Elliot was completely indifferent. He felt nothing. And the fact that he didn't care was so shocking that even he had to comment on how fucked up it was. He admitted that he knew for sure that these images would have disturbed him in the past, that his heart would have welled up with empathy and horror, that he would have turned away in disgust. But now, as he sat there, staring into the darkest corruptions of the human experience, Elliot felt nothing. And this, Damasio discovered, was the problem. While Elliot's knowledge and reasoning were left intact, the tumor and/or the surgery to remove it had debilitated his ability to empathize and feel. His inner world no longer possessed lightness and darkness, but was instead an endless gray miasma. Attending his daughter's piano recital evoked in him all the vibrancy and joyful fatherly pride as buying a new pair of socks. Losing $1 million felt exactly the same to him as pumping gas, laundering his sheets, or watching Family Feud. He had become an intellectual and medical curiosity, a pointless novelty. He was a walking, talking indifference machine. And without that ability to make value judgments, to determine better from worse, no matter how intelligent he was, Elliot had lost his self-control. But this raised a huge question. If Elliot's cognitive abilities, his intelligence, his memory, his attention, were all in perfect shape, why couldn't he make effective decisions anymore? This stumped Damasio and his colleagues. We've all wished at times that we couldn't feel emotion, because our emotions often drive us to do stupid shit we later regret. For centuries, psychologists and philosophers assumed that dampening or suppressing our emotions was the solution to all life's problems. Yet here was a man stripped of his emotions and empathy entirely, someone who had nothing but his intelligence and reasoning, and his life had quickly degenerated into a total clusterfuck. His case went against all the common wisdom about rational decision-making and self-control. But there was a second, equally perplexing question. If Elliot was still as smart as a whip and could reason his way through problems presented to him, why did his work performance fall off a cliff? Why did his productivity morph into a raging dumpster fire? Why did he essentially abandon his family, knowing full well the negative consequences? Even if you don't give a shit about your wife or your job anymore, you should be able to reason that it's still important to maintain them, right? I mean, that's what sociopaths eventually figure out. So why couldn't Elliot? Really, how hard is it to show up to a Little League game every once in a while? Somehow, by losing his ability to feel, Elliot had also lost his ability to make decisions. He'd lost the ability to control his own life. We've all had the experience of knowing what we should do, yet failing to do it. We've all put off important tasks, ignored people we care about, and failed to act in our own self-interest. And usually, when we fail to do the things we should, we assume it's because we can't sufficiently control our emotions. We're too undisciplined, or we lack knowledge. Yet Elliot's case called all of this into question. It called into question the very idea of self-control, the idea that we can logically force ourselves to do things that are good for us, despite our impulses and emotions. To generate hope in our lives, we must first feel as though we have control over our lives. We must feel as though we're following through on what we know is good and right, that we're chasing after something better. Yet many of us struggle with the inability to control ourselves. Elliot's case would be one of the breakthroughs to understanding why this occurs. This man, poor, isolated, and alone, this man staring at photos of broken bodies and earthquake rubble that could easily have been metaphors for his life, this man who had lost everything, absolutely everything, and still cracked a smile to tell about it, this man would be the key to revolutionizing our understanding of the human mind, how we make decisions, and how much self-control we actually have. The classic assumption. Once, when asked about his drinking, the singer-songwriter Tom Waits famously muttered, "I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy." He appeared to be hammered when he said it. Oh, and he was on national television. The frontal lobotomy is a form of brain surgery wherein a hole is drilled into your skull through your nose, and then the frontal lobe is gently sliced with an ice pick. The procedure was invented in 1935 by a neurologist named Antonio Egas Moniz. Egas Moniz discovered that if you took people with extreme anxiety, suicidal depression, or other mental health issues, aka crises of hope, and maimed their brain in just the right way, they'd chill the fuck out. Egas Moniz believed that the lobotomy, once perfected, could cure all mental illness, and he marketed it to the world as such. By the end of the 1940s, the procedure was a hit, being performed on tens of thousands of patients all over the world. Egas Moniz would even win a Nobel Prize for his discovery. But by the 1950s, people began to notice that, and this might sound crazy, drilling a hole through somebody's face and scraping their brain the same way you clean ice off a windshield can produce a few negative side effects. And by a few negative side effects, I mean the patients become goddamn potatoes. While often curing patients of their extreme emotional afflictions, the procedure also left them with an inability to focus, make decisions, have careers, make long-term plans, or think abstractly about themselves. Essentially, they became mindlessly satisfied zombies. They became Elliots. The Soviet Union, of all places, was the first country to outlaw the lobotomy. The Soviets declared the procedure, quote, contrary to human principles, and claimed that it, quote, turned an insane person into an idiot. This was sort of a wake-up call to the rest of the world. Because let's face it, when Joseph Stalin is lecturing you about ethics and human decency, you know you fucked up. After that, the rest of the world began, slowly, to ban the practice. And by the 1960s, pretty much everyone hated it. The last lobotomy would be performed in the United States in 1967, and the patient would die. 10 years later, a drunken Tom Waits muttered his famous line on television, and the rest, as they say, is history. Tom Waits was a blistering alcoholic who spent most of the 1970s trying to keep his eyes open and remember where he last left his cigarettes. He also found time to write and record 7 brilliant albums in this period. He was both prolific and profound, winning awards and selling millions of records that were celebrated worldwide. He was one of those rare artists whose insight into the human condition could be startling. Waits' quip about the lobotomy makes us laugh, but there's a hidden wisdom to it, that he'd rather have the problem of passion with the bottle than to have no passion at all, that it's better to find hope in lowly places than to find none, that without our unruly impulses, we are nothing. There's pretty much always been a tacit assumption that our emotions cause all our problems and that our reason must swoop in to clean up the mess. This line of thinking goes all the way back to Socrates, who declared reason the root of all virtue. At the beginning of the Enlightenment, Descartes argued that our reason was separate from our animalistic desires and that it had to learn to control those desires. Kant said sort of the same thing. Freud, too, except there were a lot of penises involved. And when Egasmoniz lobotomized his first patient in 1935, I'm sure he thought he had just discovered a way to do what for more than 2,000 years philosophers had declared needed to be done, to grant reason dominion over the unruly passions, to help humanity finally exercise some damn control over itself. This assumption, that we must use our rational mind to dominate our emotions, has trickled down through the centuries and continues to define much of our culture today. Let's call it the classic assumption. The classic assumption says that if a person is undisciplined, unruly, or malicious, it's because he lacks the ability to subjugate his feelings, that he is weak-willed or just plain fucked up. The classic assumption sees passion and emotion as flaws, errors within the human psyche that must be overcome and fixed within the self. Today, we usually judge people based on the classic assumption. Obese people are ridiculed and shamed because their obesity is seen as a failure of self-control. They know they should be thin, yet they continue to eat. Why? Something must be wrong with them, we assume. Smokers, same deal. Drug addicts receive the same treatment, of course, but often with the extra stigma of being defined as criminals. Depressed and suicidal people are subjected to the classic assumption in a way that's dangerous, being told that their inability to create hope and meaning in their lives is their own damn fault, that maybe if they just tried a little harder, hanging themselves by the necktie wouldn't sound so appealing. We see succumbing to our emotional impulses as a moral failing. We see a lack of self-control as a sign of a deficient character. Conversely, we celebrate people who beat their emotions into submission. We get collective hard-ons for athletes and businessmen and leaders who are ruthless and robotic in their efficiency. If a CEO sleeps under his desk and doesn't see his kids for 6 weeks at a time, fuck yeah, that's determination. See? Anyone can be successful. Clearly, it's not hard to see how the classic assumption can lead to some damaging, assumptions. If the classic assumption is true, then we should be able to exhibit self-control, prevent emotional outbursts and crimes of passion, and stave off addiction and indulgences through mental effort alone. And any failure to do so reflects something inherently faulty or damaged within us. This is why we often develop the false belief that we need to change who we are. Because if we can't achieve our goals, if we can't lose the weight or get the promotion or learn the skill, then that signifies some internal deficiency. Therefore, in order to maintain hope, we decide that we must change ourselves, become somebody totally new and different. This desire to change ourselves then refills us with hope. The old me couldn't shake that terrible smoking habit, but the new me will, and we're off to the races again. The constant desire to change yourself then becomes its own sort of addiction. Each cycle of changing yourself results in similar failures at self-control, therefore making you feel as though you need to change yourself all over again. Each cycle refuels you with the hope you're looking for. Meanwhile, the classic assumption, the root of the problem, is never addressed or questioned, let alone thrown out. Like a bad case of acne, a whole industry has sprouted up over the past couple of centuries around this change yourself idea. This industry is replete with false promises and clues to the secrets of happiness, success, and self-control. Yet all the industry does is reinforce the same impulses that drive people to feel inadequate in the first place. I know this because I'm unfortunately part of this industry. The truth is that the human mind is far more complex than any secret, and you can't simply change yourself, nor, I would argue, should you always feel you must. We cling to this narrative about self-control because the belief that we're in complete control of ourselves is a major source of hope. We want to believe that changing ourselves is as simple as knowing what to change. We want to believe that the ability to do something is as simple as deciding to do it and mustering enough willpower to get there. We want to believe ourselves to be the masters of our own destiny, capable of anything we can dream. This is what made DiMaggio's discovery with Eliot such a big deal. It showed that the classic assumption is wrong. If the classic assumption were true, if life were as simple as learning to control one's emotions and make decisions based on reason, then Eliot should have been an unstoppable badass, tirelessly industrious, and a ruthless decision maker. Similarly, if the classic assumption were true, lobotomies should be all the rage. We'd all be saving up for them as if they were boob jobs. But lobotomies don't work, and Eliot's life was ruined. The fact is that we require more than willpower to achieve self-control. It turns out that our emotions are instrumental in our decision-making and our actions. We just don't always realize it. You have two brains, and they're really bad at talking to each other. Let's pretend your mind is a car. Let's call it the consciousness car. Your consciousness car is driving along the road of life, and there are intersections, on-ramps, and off-ramps. You can select different routes and potentially arrive at an infinite number of destinations. These roads and intersections represent the decisions you make as you drive, and they will determine your destination. Now, there are two travelers in your consciousness car, a thinking brain and a feeling brain. The thinking brain represents your conscious thoughts, your ability to make calculations, and your ability to reason through various options and express ideas through language. Your feeling brain represents your emotions, impulses, intuition, and instincts. While your thinking brain is calculating payment schedules on your credit card statement, your feeling brain wants to sell everything and run away to Tahiti. Each of your two brains has its strengths and weaknesses. The thinking brain is conscientious, accurate, and impartial. It is methodical and rational, but it is also slow. It requires a lot of effort and energy, and like a muscle, it must be built up over time and can become fatigued if overexerted. The feeling brain, however, arrives at its conclusions quickly and effortlessly. The problem is that it is often inaccurate and irrational. The feeling brain is also a bit of a drama queen and has a bad habit of overreacting. When we think of ourselves and our decision-making, we generally assume that the thinking brain is driving our consciousness car and the feeling brain is sitting in the passenger seat, shouting out where it wants to go. We're driving along, accomplishing our goals and figuring out how to get home when that damn feeling brain sees something shiny or sexy or fun-looking and yanks the steering wheel in a direction we don't want to go, thus causing us to careen into oncoming traffic, harming other people's consciousness cars as well as our own. This is the classic assumption, the belief that our reason is ultimately in control of our life and that we must train our emotions to sit the fuck down and shut up while the adult is driving. We then applaud this kidnapping and abuse of our emotions by congratulating ourselves on our self-control. But our consciousness car doesn't work that way. When his tumor was removed, Eliot's feeling brain got thrown out of his moving mental vehicle, and nothing got better for him. In fact, his consciousness car stalled out. Lobotomy patients had their feeling brains tied up and thrown in the car's trunk, and that merely caused them to become sedated and lazy, unable to get out of bed or even dress themselves much of the time. Meanwhile, Tom Waits was pretty much all